we're going to continue our series on Carolyn Gorton's book, Digital Prohibition, subtitled Piracy and Authorship in New Media Art. So go ahead and indicate where you're quoting from best you can.
Well, I made a note while I was listening to the musical portion of the show, and you played a lot of electronic music, and I've never listened to much electronic music, but I see it as extreme pattern interrupt, where your mind can't follow any logical progression in the music, so you either just get frustrated and turn it off, or you just go with the blinks and plinks in your mind and knowing that there's nothing there for you to grab onto. So, pattern interrupt, is that the way to describe electronic music? Yeah, you're on mute.
You want to turn your volume down
now? It's done. It's off.
Okay, I guess it's on my... I'm going to turn this down.
Electronic music.
Okay, so McLuhan says electronic music is tactile music. So you're not looking for melody, harmonies, and rhythms. There's something else that the composers are trying to communicate.
Yeah.
The melody was the literate road. Start, middle, go somewheres, creating harmony along the way. Sound was becoming tactilized by the radio, the electric radio environment. So the composers felt the need to move sound into a multi-locational, decentralized, no central keys, post-visual space mode. And so it was the idea of the music, the concept, more than the aesthetic pleasure that motivated these guys. But people like Zappa, they just want to hear what things sound like. So they're exploring their ears. And maybe Hugh LaCaine was like that.
Back to where you said it was just music, electronic music was what? Just to hear what it sounded like?
Yeah,
so that's what artists are doing. They're just doing art to see what happens. They have nothing, no focused future in mind.
That's why McLuhan came in and said the series artist knows the effect they want to create. Mm-hmm. All right? Like Edgar Allan Poe, he started that doctrine. The symbolists picked it up, and then the voices picked it up. So if you're just exploring to see what something sounds like, that traditionally would just be a subjective masturbation.
Mm-hmm.
What is your reasoning for permitting or wanting an audience to hear your stuff? You must have an effect if you're serious that you want to create, and usually it's anti-environmental. Usually it's trying to unnumb people's habitual patterns. So, but once you got into the 60s and 70s, when the environments, television, satellite, computers were altering people's perceptions and being the mm-hmm. pattern interrupt,
mm-hmm.
That sort of freed up old composing, musical composing, to be subjectively based on your wants and desires, not as an anti-environment.
Mm-hmm.
But
people didn't know that. They were manipulated by the new change environment. They didn't have a clue.
Like rock and roll.
Yeah, well, like I'm reading Patti Smith's biography that Little Sarah suggested. And it's a perfect example of Patti and her friend Robert Mapplethorpe, who were just being buffeted around by the media environment of the time to think that they wanted to be artists and musicians and creators.
Yeah, that was a romanticization of the new electronic mandate that you had to create your own spaces. No longer were you matching with what your teachers taught you, with what society said to do. People McLuhan wrote about this, they were forced to become probers of their environment.
Yeah.
And the model for Western kids was artists. And so they...
Artists and musicians.
Well, artists, I mean creators. Everybody's an art, sculptor, poets, playwrights, musicians, painters. They're all artists, but creators in the arts, in the Gutenberg arts. So this was the new identity for baby boomers.
Right, but they thought they were being individualist. They were breaking, you know, away from the mold and
now part of the
running
reason,
away from home. But
no, I need to respond to that point.
Yeah,
in the 50s, you had the bland come in with television, the conformist 50s generation.
Oh, that was just a programmed environment there to make everybody be Ozzie and Harriet.
No, you're going by the content. The because the tactile mesh of black and white TV forced people to make an image, people couldn't handle doing that. At least they weren't going to be aware of it, so they fell back on the previous environment, industrial homogeneity and mass conformity, and everybody wearing the same uniform. That became a comforting cliche, a comforting archetype for the generation of the 50s. They fell back on celebrating matching. But that was then superseded by the computer in the late 50s, early 60s, and then the satellite decentralization. So by the late 60s, when Mapplethorpe and Patty are, you know, starving in Brooklyn, now people start to move out of the 50s mandate to match its nostalgia or its a comforting nostalgia. Now they're going to do creativity. They're going to make their own spaces. So they retrieve 19th century artists. The idea of individual expression, and they were doing their own thing under the mandate of the satellite effect, because the satellite is rotating around the planet and all the previous analogical media environments. So you, the subconscious effect of satellites is that you're above, you've transcended the hypnotic industrial media environments, so you start to think, oh, I'm going to do my own thing.
Yeah.
And the cultural archetype for doing your own thing were the artists, the Rambos, the who did they, who'd she have on her...
on her wall, yeah, she had Rambo, Warhol.
Couple of Hollywood people.
Lotte Lenya.
Yeah, German world, yeah, 30s, I guess.
But, yes, they couldn't be individuals. They always
now,
had
mixed
to have
media.
A role model.
Yeah, now it's interesting to have a mixed... They these two young poets had mixed media icons, not just from the Gutenberg art.
Well, yeah.
Movie stars, music stars...
Yeah.
And media stars
the
like Warhol.
Yeah, the prevailing atmosphere allowed them to be immediately manipulative because
right.
they had the different influences.
They did not like to conform. No, they did not like to have to put up with someone telling them what to do, which is the Walter Cronkite world, the corporate culture that came in with the 50s and 60s, early 60s. It happened, you know, with rock and roll. They did.
But they didn't realize that they were programmed without even knowing it, and that's where...
No, they knew they were programmed and
well,
thought their way...
Well, programmed by Warhol and Rimbaud and all
those guys. No. Wait a minute. Most people assumed they were... They could see the rearview mirror. They could see the mass industrial environment.
Yeah.
And they thought, oh, that's totalitarian, and I'm going to be free of that. And the decentralized electronic media allowed them to be less controlled, like having a transistor radio or whatever else came in the late 60s, but the video cameras. So you have people trying to become individualist because the media actually supports that, but they're fighting a rearview mirror battle because they only can see the Gorgon of the past, the industrial homogeneity, but they unfortunately pick old artists as models for their autonomy and individualism, not knowing that the new arts, the satellite environment itself, was what was making them become individualistic. So you had the phenomenon of Laurie Anderson. I witnessed her at the New York premiere of the documentary on McLuhan called McLuhan's Wake, about 2005. She's the narrator on it, Laurie Anderson of New York and Lou Reed partnership. The late Lou Reed. So when she, we watched the documentary, and then at the end she got up to speak, and the first thing she said, she said, that is a beautiful idea. I'd never heard of that before, that the satellites environments, the satellite world, created a global theater. Now, this is 2005. This is 40 years after McLuhan laid out the idea. But it never occurred to her that she was responding to in a theatrical situation in the media environment that the satellite brought in. That's typical of artists of the last 25 years. They did not know that they were replaying old ideas of creativity and didn't know what McLuhan was pointing out, a new level of creativity, to the point the Android meme dominates creativity. They taught, in postmodernism they call it, or in French theory they call it, the colonization of the imagination. So here's Patti Smith and Mapplethorpe trying to retrieve Gutenberg images and a few media images like Warhol and Lotte Lenya to express their independence of media, not knowing that that's a programmed effect of the satellite.
They're
programmed to feel that they can do their own thing.
Right.
And, of course, they get into trouble as they do their various expressions. It always crashes. And, you know, Patti Smith crashed several times in her career. Mapplethorpe died, you know. Didn't make it.
Didn't make it. Yeah, so they're, as Roxana is saying, they're searching for God or Godness, and they'll never find it unless they embrace Ion.
Well, they embrace our products, the RNA drops. Ion does not want them to embrace what Ion says. Ion is demanding people to participate with Ion and all the levels that Ion can do. And most people can't perceive the levels they can interact with Ion. So Ion is the new song. Ion is up there playing and performing and asking people to join the band. And not in conventional ways. But Ion is saying that it would help you to understand what Ion is talking about or being and frequencying about if they took the drops. Ion's going so far as to say, you got to take drops or you're gone. You're not going to make it. The world is changing on levels that humans never imagined before, not caused by media, but by other dimensions of the mystery landscape, like the eye cell that's coming in, and people are going to feel increasingly uncomfortable and not know why and want to check out. And they don't know where they hope to check to. The guff ain't going to be there anymore.
Right.
So it's the most radical, devastating. It's way worse than the species disappearing. People worrying about a, you know, post-human situation. It's way beyond that. It's post-universe.
Yeah, because the media is being so obviously exposed. Wired magazine, et cetera, et cetera. Then obviously there's something.
No,
else.
What's that sentence mean? Media are being exposed.
That people are blaming the media for everything, and it's on the hot seat. And that's because there's something that's wrapped around it. The RNA drops.
Right, right. Now, yeah, that was, they're looking at the rearview mirror. They think the media is the problem.
Right.
And so they're going to hoik up an old-fashioned image, some guy with funny hair who's telling the media to fuck itself, and he can become president with that image, which is going to be great. It's going to be a lot of fun with that guy.
You're talking about Trump.
Yeah, if he becomes president, it's going to be hilarious. Mm-hmm. Of course, it won't help anybody deal with the issue that the eye cell is mutating everybody globally. And, yeah, people are lashing out with what they think is making them uncomfortable, and they don't know it's us and eye cell. So that's Ion, Iondom. So this is what Carolyn Guertin is going to have to deal with as she becomes aware of what we're talking about. I mean,
well, you bringing up Trump makes me think of somebody sent me what Canada is doing this weekend. They've accepted their first boatload, plane load of Syrians, and all of Canada has come out to welcome them.
Well, that's Canada trying to retrieve its old image as in any environment, a sentimental.
Does Canada just do everything opposite of what America does?
Yes. Now, here's an important point. Bruce Powell, in the McLuhan Centenary in 2011, he was in some panel in Germany or someplace, Barcelona, and I caught him saying this. He said that he knew a man in the RCMP or CSIS in government Canadian intelligence. And the person told Bruce Powell that the Canadian intelligence agencies and the government made a deal with terrorists that we will let you stay in Canada. You can blow up the Empire State Building and the World Trade Center as long as you don't do anything in Canada. So Bruce says that Canada is the biggest safe house, the safe haven for terrorists in the present situation. And he said this 4 years ago. So that's very interesting that, yes, Canada can welcome all the terrorists or whatever they are, these Syrian refugees, because they know that they're not going to get bombed, but the rest of the world is going to get bombed. So all the terrorists are now going to be playing in Toronto, in our street, Ellsworth Street, where we used to live, or down in McLuhan's, Witchwood Avenue. You're going to be down there. And so what Bruce said is very important. That it should be a congressional investigation of Canada. Canada, and there should be a parliamentary investigation of Canada. In Canada, Bruce Powell was sitting on, that's P-O-W-E, sitting on a, you know, a time bomb. So,
do you think Justin Trudeau knows that this deal was made?
It doesn't matter what he knows. He's not in charge. He's just there to be an actor. I mean, that's all you can be as a politician, just a guy hoiking up the homeopathic image of Canada. So let them have all the... And, of course, Canada could look good because the terrorists ain't going to blow anybody up in Canada because that's the deal for them to be able to come in and sit
look
in Canada.
Look at Bob, knowing everything again.
Yeah, I know everything about what's happening, yes, just by listening to my colleagues and their haphazard interviews. You know, Bruce said that. It was nobody mm-hmm. responded to it, but it's an interesting...
He said it in public?
Yeah, it was a public seminar on the McLuhan Centenary in Europe. Now, what's interesting about Bruce, his father was involved with the Liberal Party. Bruce was involved with the Liberal Party. He did the only interviews with Justin's father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, in the 80s when Trudeau wasn't talking to anybody after he retired. So
uh-huh.
Bruce had some kind of connection with some of the elite in the Liberal Party and maybe someone in the Secret Service like Bruce and then became a confidant of him. But that is a statement that you have to give Bruce credit for being the only person who knows that, mm-hmm. and he said it, and it's something to keep in mind. And so here's Canada, so they'll have a nice image of being a lovely place, yet, you know, the Syrians, well, the terrorists, whoever they are going to be winning all over the rest of the world thanks to the safe haven that Canada provided for them. So, you know, it's not worth thinking about, you know, because it's not going to turn out the way anybody thinks it's.
No.
Hopefully turn out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's see. But, you know, Roxana would consider Canadians really irresponsible because she's in Germany, in Berlin, and dealing with this terrible effect of the refugees in her town mm-hmm. and ruining the situation there. You know, and so the old liberals and humanists and whatever they are that Canada thinks they represent, they are pissed in Europe.
Yeah.
And
well, the images, like the it's either a Facebook or something here, just shows the little families with little children. It doesn't. It does not show the terrorists lined up.
Do you remember when Estherelka? The person who created the Trudeau reality, very
yeah.
wealthy family,
yeah.
Esaraco drove us through customs
right.
in Buffalo on September 15th, a few days after 9/11. She had a car with diplomatic plates to drive us up to the border and get us to Toronto a few days after 9/11. At the border, the woman, the clerk there,
customs agent,
recognized her name
yeah.
and said, do you know the minister of whatever it is, immigration?
Immigration.
And Esaraco said, of course I do. Yes, I do. She said, well, will you tell her a message? That we've been noticing that people come here at the border and they have a little kid.
They have a whole group of them.
Okay,
they have four
do?
Or five children.
Yeah.
And then a few days later, those same children come through again.
They get through customs because the agents take sympathy on these little children, and so the parents get through, right?
Like families are allowed in, and they get some sort of vouchers, welfare
yeah.
money and everything.
And then the next week, another bunch of parents will show up with the same children that got through a week ago.
Right,
and
right.
she said they kept recycling children, and for some reason, the customs agents were complaining, sending it up to the top,
mm-hmm.
and nobody would do anything about it.
Right.
And so the children thing is used by the terrorists.
Yeah, probably children aren't fingerprinted, so there's no way of keeping track.
Now, when I was in Toronto in... 1997, I met this man, and he worked for the RCMP. And he was telling me, and this is in 97 at the peak of the dot-com boom, and everybody thinks everything's happy and happy times in New York City and all this stuff. And he says, he is so pissed off because he said, and he named a couple of politicians in Toronto. I think they were like City Hall guys. He says, these guys are drug dealers and bringing terrorists in. He named these local politicians who were getting away with murder, and nobody believed him. He reported to his seniors, and he was really pissed off. And so I didn't think much of that at that time. I mean, I didn't know whether he was real or not. But then 2 or 3 years later, then 911 happens. That's what that guy was talking about. And there was a lot of investigation of the terrorist links to Toronto. Mm-hmm. So this poor guy in the RCMP, mm-hmm. you know, top agent kind of guy, working at the deepest levels of counterintelligence, whatever it is, he saw that politicians were bringing drugs and terrorists and weapons into Toronto, and he couldn't get anybody to do anything about it. Now, it's his fault for thinking that he could do anything about it. These people didn't listen to me when I was on CKLN and told them, well, there was nobody left. Everything's disappeared. They didn't understand that. But what am I going to do about it? What I'm going to do about it is what I'm doing now. But I didn't know I could do that in 97. I didn't predict I'd do something, but we didn't know it was this. They signed him. So happy days are here once for me. But now back to, now why are you bringing this up? What's this got to do with digital prohibition? With this book? What do you?
You brought up Trump. And Trump is anti-Syrians and Justin Trudeau.
Trump is anti-everything.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know much about what he says, but
he speaks to the grumpiness in everybody.
But I read Matt Taibbi's column on ranting about Trump and how people are missing the real meaning of him. I didn't know that. He said, what are we going to do with the internet? He said, we're going to shut it down. So he says crazy things, and I think that's wonderful that he does, but I do not know what he said. And my point is he wants to shut everything down. He wants to have some kind of replay of what? New York City? Where is he from? He's a real estate mogul's son.
He's appealing to the grumpiness in everybody.
Yes.
He just says no to everything.
Yeah, no to everything. That's right. No to everything. The great refusal.
Yeah.
You know, the anarchists and the situationists and the psychogeographers and all the people that Carolyn Guertin celebrates, the great refusers, they're going to love Trump because he's doing the great refusal.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine that way. We'll shut the internet off. I mean, how can you turn the Android beam off? That's crazy. So I'm glad I'm not paying too much attention, and any little whiffs I get of it, I find very enjoyable, and I know it has nothing to do with what's really going on, which is what's really going on, despite anybody's incredulity. We are. We got the great physician here who can treat anything properly and usefully, and we get the testimonies all the time. That's a nice practical thing to cite. Medicine. You can always say, hey, buddy, can you help this person? We can. You can't. So we got that little edge there. So back to some quotes from this. What were you saying? Okay, I brought up Trump, but what was your... Oh, we're talking about the decent... Oh, well,
Syrians. He rejects Smith. The Syrians, but Canada accepted them. Yeah, and before that was Patti Smith and how the artists just are programmed zombies in the new environment.
I used to say that Canada was the Switzerland of the solar government. Okay, back in the 80s and 90s, Switzerland, remember, stayed out of World War II, and yet everybody could do their dirty business, banking, whatever, through Switzerland because it sat on the sidelines.
Right.
Like McLuhan said, the Gutenberg economists or bankers, Visual Space, sat on the sidelines in the 20th century while all the new electric media had civil war among themselves. So Canada is the Switzerland of the solar government. It sits there looking pretty and passive and pacifist and wonderful image, and while the storm is being manufactured out of Toronto.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, can you imagine trying to tell Justin this? If I met Justin on a Toronto subway, I quote him, hey, you know what Bruce Powell said? A good friend of your father wrote an essay about your father, man. Guess what he's saying?
Mm-hmm.
And immediately I'd be pushed up against the subway walls by the security and marched off to the local jailhouse, right?
Or psychiatric institute.
So there's no Justin. There is no Canada. It's like it's a front for that's how close the terrorists is. They've got all of Canada right along the Canadian border. They're right up against the United States, the Great Beast. They're right beside it.
Mm-hmm.
They own Canada.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you dumb fucking Canadians. You people run around thinking you're Canadians. You're so fucking silly. There's no Americans either, too. You can take comfort in that. Okay, back to our four-body situation.
And
so, Patty, so what was your opening theme?
You said back to the book. Let's go back to the book.
Yeah, the rearview mirror. So you're reading about Patti Smith and and the way she's latching on, holding on to rearview mirror images of media archetypes mm-hmm. to give her an identity, and that's not good enough. Mm-hmm. All people of the baby boomer generation and the next generation, Generation X, if they don't study McLuhan in depth, like Carolyn Guertin has done,
mm-hmm.
I assume Carolyn has done, she does very good essays using McLuhan, they don't know anything. And they don't understand what problems are coming to them. It doesn't matter. The only guy that kind of survived this was Zappa. And Zappa had the benefits of my wisdom given to him. And he also yeah. had some kind of instinctive genius about what was going on. He had a crude McLuhan-esque view. And he had integrity. He knew that he was creating an anti-environment, did that and didn't take drugs or spend money on silly things for any other reason. He just stayed in the traditional Garrett mentality of an artist. So, but even he got killed, you know? So be prepared. Okay, so...
let me get into the book then.
Yeah.
Thanks for that diversion.
Digression. That's a Manipian digression.
Mm. So I'm just jumping around. I've highlighted some things that we haven't talked about yet, although, you know, I haven't finished the book. But I found something that kind of identifies the TV body. So the paragraph is...
That's just the echo. I'm moving the computer.
Automated.
Okay, let me just plug this in so you don't get bothered. Just a second.
Thank you.
Oh, I want to announce this. No. Go ahead.
Automated systems of surveillance, millions of CCTV cameras in bank machines, offices, schools, corporate and government buildings, traffic lights inside taxi cabs in the United Kingdom. Do modify people's behavior. What is hard to predict, however, is how to control or even measure the effects of such modifications. So do we say that's the TV body being surveilled by cameras all the time?
Well, it's more the chip body.
That's
a chip body. But can you give me the page number, the context for this?
Okay. This was in my Kindle, but I have the book up on the screen, and I will search that paragraph just for you. It is on page 96.
Okay, so what's the title of the chapter?
I don't know. Page 96, so it's probably page, 95 or 97.
Yeah, so it's called Capture. Capture / leakage in brackets performance plus documentation, and this is the section of the book that is called. It's part one. The aesthetics of appropriation is the main headline for part one. Then the four divisions are interruption
mm-hmm.
in brackets stoppage plus repetition, or maybe that's an and sign. Then disturbance, in brackets, action plus event. Then capture / leakage, in brackets, performance plus documentation. And then part four, dynamic data and augmented bodies. So that's her description of the characteristics, interruption, disturbance, and capture leakage of the Android meme. She's calling it the digital environment, and that is the chip body, largely the chip body. Because the chip body can interrupt the TV landscape. It can disturb the landscape, and it can capture and leak things.
Did you see where she says below, all of these approaches, interruption, disturbance, capture, leakage, are non-visual, dynamic, interactive, and participatory?
Right. I need to know what's the beginning words of the paragraph. See if I can find the paragraph mm-hmm. of that section.
All these approaches, does that help?
All these approaches. So I'm looking at 97.
I'll look for it. It's on, it's way back on page 40.
What? Well, what? Why are we saying 97?
Because that's where the first quote was. And
okay, I'm going back to the first quote.
Yeah,
97.
But I'm staying in a...
I know, we'll get to that. Let's do this first quote. And what does the paragraph begin that starts that? See, I can just scan the paragraph beginnings, and I'll find where this particular quote...
All these approaches, interruption, disturbance, capture, leak, are non-visual, dynamic, interactive, and participatory. Is that what you want?
the opening statement of banks and surveillance is in a paragraph. What is the opening words of that paragraph?
Automated systems of surveillance.
Okay, so look at this. Automated surveillance. This is a problem. You got Kindle and a hard copy. See?
And I have an online copy.
See? How does this work? The video diaries, Egyptian artist. McLuhan said the environments. McLuhan argued that the media is digital cultural resistance. Which one has your sentence?
Automated systems of surveillance. Let me. Too much media.
Right.
So it's at the top of that page.
Within spectacular culture.
Mm-hmm.
There it is. So it's page 96, which is where you were.
Mm-hmm.
So where is the part that you were quoting about the banks?
Automated system, right there.
All right. So it says, automated systems of surveillance. Automated systems of surveillance. Millions of CCTV cameras in bank machines, offices, schools, corporate and government buildings, traffic lights, inside taxi cabs in the United Kingdom do modify people's behavior. What it is hard to predict, however, is how to control or even measure the effect of such modifications.
And you know what just struck me is I watch a lot of these spy TV series, and they can follow a person all around a city by all the surveillance cameras, bank machines, ATMs, and all. It's changed movies and TV shows, that's for sure, just like the cell phone changed.
It didn't change, it just show it.
Well, it allowed them to use that technology and made their
the TV, what
the
allowed
content.
They're just showing what is. The TV shows are news. They're showing you what's available. It's like it might be a fictional TV show, but it's like a documentary showing you what the actual environment consists of. But here's the important point.
Mm-hmm.
She's saying, or somebody says, what is hard to predict, however, is how to control or even measure the effects of such modifications. Well, that's my theme. Mm-hmm. The Android meme is measuring itself. The chemical body is not being affected by these environments, and yet these concerned chemical bodies are saying, well, how's it affecting people? The people aren't involved anymore. It's surveillance by one part of the Android meme over other parts, and the chemical body is just wandering around getting caught in the crossfire.
Yes.
It does not change people, people's chemical bodies.
It does.
The people's chemical bodies are ghetto, guys, are dumped.
It changes them totally. That's what we talked about last week, where the masses pervasive stress on the body.
There's only one change. The despondency that you're not relevant. That's the malaise that people feel.
Mm-hmm.
They feel that their chemical, they don't think of it this way, but in actual fact, their chemical body is gone. It's useless. There's no context.
Okay.
And that'll depress people and make them take medications all the time.
Yeah, so that stresses them out, but then it's the stress that modifies every part of their body.
Yeah, it's one effect, and that effect's been around for 15 or 20 years.
But when you stress the whole body in 1,000 different ways, then that's why there's no identifier with what's really causing
it. There's no 1,000 different ways. There's only one effect. What did Kroeker write in the early 90s? Flesh is surplus flesh. Chemical body is gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's not constituent. It's obsolete. Now, most people go around with their little chemical body brains. They don't perceive that. They just feel some kind of a ripped-off factor.
Okay, but then that's translated into the physical body by all the symptoms of headaches and
insomnia. Yeah, we know. That's why everybody's medicated.
Yeah.
Yeah, we know that.
So you can't say it's one thing because it manifests.
No, there's one cause. What's only one cause. When you wipe out the human species, that's enough. It's over for the human chemical body. It's done.
Right.
They're just lingering surplus flesh, which is the great phrase Kroeker uses. We're looking at surplus flesh on the chemical body.
Right.
But also people are growing TV bodies and chip bodies. And that's what they're engaged in while they're staring at their iPhones all the time.
Right.
But they think they're watching their own chemical body get free or something. And they can't figure out why they feel bad while they're enjoying the bliss of surfing their iPhones.
Okay, so the TV body and chip body are anesthetizing, or they're already anesthetized. And
it's where people live, and they don't have a way to perceive that they're living there. They still think that they perceive they're some kind of chemical body, and they accept the programming of it by meds and medications and all the stupid shit they do themselves to assuage some little one-fifth of themselves, which is in pain because it's been chopped off. It's literally chopped off. I mean, look at Catherine Hale. She writes a book, How We Became Post-Human. Now, she doesn't know how radical that what the words mean there, but at least she's teaching it, and that's back in 20 years ago. You know, they teach this, How We Became Post-Human. But they don't know why they became post-human. So this thing, here you got this chemical body person, Chris Ravetto Biaggioli, in 2010, saying we don't have any way to predict or figure out what modifications are being done to people under all the surveillance. Well, they won't get to square one if they start worrying about the flesh is not being modulated anymore. The medium is a message doesn't apply anymore. The medium is a message is what's going on between the android constituents, which is the TV body, the chip body, the after image of the chemical body, and the after image of the astral body. And actually, the astral plane is an after image now, as the Gup has changed, as Ian has shown us. So even that, heaven ain't what it used to be. And hell ain't used to be what it used to be. So now, she gives this quote. Carolyn Gorton gives this quote. And then she says, within spectacular culture, which is the TV body, TV landscape becoming miniaturized, the TV body, the spectacle, that's a phrase from the 60s. Within spectacular culture, he or she who controls representation possesses the power to visualize data and shape his or her own narratives. Cameras capture data and produce low-res images and objects, which could become aestheticized. What happens if we reverse the usual paradigm? What if surveillance technology is inverted and the subject takes back control his or her own military industrial data that are increasingly leaky? She goes on, and it's a lot of confusion here because she's mixing her bodies and wondering what the chemical body is going to do, and if you're not in charge of the White House, you can't control the TV landscape. So a lot of confusion here. Now, she subsequently picks apart her own brain and comes up with interesting patterns that could show she's working her way out of these questions. But you'd have to find those quotes for me to point that out. So, back to, you're asking me if this is the chip body, the automated systems of surveillance. Yes, they're automated. Mm-hmm. Remember, McLuhan's definition of the President of the United States was an automated presidential surrogate who's a superlative nobody. That's how you become president. You're going to become an automated presidential surrogate substitute. You're not going to be the actual president. You're going to act it out. So automated systems of surveillance do modify people's behavior. No, it doesn't modify people's behavior. It modifies other aspects of the technical landscape known as the Android meme. Like television shows, they have to start showing that as content in their fictional crime dramas. Right, that's they're changed just by updating what they show.
Yeah.
And it's appalling how most TV shows now of the dramatic level are just people on their cell phones, constantly communicating on their cell phones. There's no acting going on. They're just reacting to how cleverly you can flip your phone on. Have you ever noticed that? You watch the slower shows, the doctor shows, and the I don't know what they're called, Leverage and Royal Pains, and these different slower community. Doctor goes around, does a MacGyver, and solves a problem in Long Island or something, right?
Yeah.
But when you're looking at Jessica Jones, the new Marvel comic show, you're looking at Homeland, whatever other pretty good shows are out there.
24,
but that's before. Take The Good Wife. They're lawyers, and they're always on the cell phone dealing with whatever crisis is coming up as they act out their lawyer dramas.
Yeah.
It's incredible how your constant cell phone interaction is going on, which is really showing people that even though you're looking at Julie Margulies and the actresses of The Good Wife, and you think that's what they are, these chemical bodies. No, it's the chip body, the thing, the hand that's constantly interacting and responding to the cell phone. That's the chip body. That's a visualization of it.
And what it has done is it sped everything up.
That's an old cliche. Mm-hmm. It sped up the chemical body 20, 30 years ago and killed the chemical body, removed it. So it's the Android meme that's being sped up. And so it speeds up the TV show, the TV world, in the making of it, and makes increasingly great numbers of programs of last 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. But the chip body isn't speeding up. The chip body is sitting there like a Chinese emperor, wearing the whole multi-leveled universes. It's putting it all on because it's beyond time and space. So there's no movement in the chip body. There's just rippling of imagistic ticklings of each other, of the parts of the Android meme.
Yes, that made me think of something. I won't be able to find it. You know, going beyond, there's something about going beyond the media experience that she talks about, or going beyond the digital, but I don't know if that's possible. If we've got the Android meme,
the chemical body can't go beyond the digital.
Right.
The other parts of the Android meme can push holopathically the digital setup of the moment, and then create more miniaturization, more decentralization. And I should explain that the definition of holopathy.
Uh-huh.
You found something?
I found a quote.
Mm-hmm. So the definition of holopathy, one of the aspects is it's an interplay of co-anesthesia and synesthesia. So the mixing of the chemical body senses and then the digital extensions of those senses is synesthesia. And that fragments, that confuses, that's surrealistic, and people like that. But there's a parallel movement of integration into the global membrane. You could say Big Brother's monitoring everybody. Well, that integration and giving you the ability to integrate is called co-anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
These two terms are written about by Donald Thiel. And so the tactile process, the interplay of the non-sensory and the non-machinic, which is the extended tactility, is best understood in visualizing co-anesthesia and synesthesia is happening at the same time. Both processes, integration and decentralization, fragmentation, miniaturization.
Both and?
Both and. It's happening. So with that in mind, what does your quote say?
Yes. As information moves off.
And what page is this?
Oh, yeah. You got to bring Bob up to speed. Up to my speed.
And notice, all that Ion said, and has said the last 6 years, is ways of making it simple to people and the effects of it across the board in all dimensions, what I'm describing as advanced McLuhanism or advanced Zappaism or advanced Cokerism. The stasis that all communication has arrived at is the reason Ion comes forth and says all the things it says. It basically says you've already arrived. It's happened technically. And people can't see the technical environment, and that Ion is representing the closest description of that from another worldly source.
Page 111.
And what does the paragraph begin with?
As information moves off our screens and into the world.
See, that's the paragraph? I don't see a paragraph saying...
I know, Bob, but you will.
As information moves...
Next paragraph is dynamic data or data...
All right, I got that. Dynamic data, so go back. Okay, so what part of as information? I found
it's this whole section. As information moves off our screens and into the world, it is apparent that the next big thing will be augmented interfaces.
Right. Now, those would be, as information moves off our screens, that would say that's a description of a part of the Android meme. If you think information comes through your TV landscape, which has been miniaturized into your TV body, so it comes off our TV screens, but it can also mean your computer screens and into the world. Which world? See, that's not an accurate statement. Mm-hmm. As information moves off our screens and into the world, well, the world is already the Android meme, and that's all it is. It is apparent that the next big thing will be augmented interfaces. That'll be just the next little wrinkle of a chip in your head.
Chip in your head,
or something. Some closer involvement that's even tighter than the involvement you already had the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. And McLuhan would say you last 100 years. Because once radio came in, you had merged with the electronic spaces. Mm-hmm. So as information moves off our screens into the world, that's a badly stated aspect. As the Android meme evolves and fragments and extends itself and does a tetron on its own components, mm-hmm. it's apparent that the next big thing will be shocking to you because you'll be more glued in to the Android meme, your chemical body after image, than you expect. So that's how I take that sentence. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, that's good. I'll go there.
So you wanted to bring this out because it's a good statement?
Well, because my question at the top was, but will it? Will we be, she implies that we'll be free of them,
no.
I think. As information moves off our screen, she implies that the screens will get blank and it'll go into our head. Is that what she's saying?
Yes, and she calls it the world. See, it's not, you know, if you use my language, you have to talk precisely, and this is not a precise sentence. You wouldn't write it, but she doesn't know my stuff. So it's a lazy statement, and into the world, like which world? And she spends the whole book describing the discarnate, electrified, transistorized, digitized world. It's not the world. It's not a chemical body world. It's not nature.
Right.
So the next thing, when Doug...
Yeah, this is neat. When Douglas C. Engelbart conceived of the personal computer as a tool for the augmentation of the human.
That's about 1968. He did a famous demonstration of the mouse, I guess you could say.
He foresaw an expansion of the intellect by virtual means, not as an architectural addition to real space. So
that's, again, not... He didn't know what he was. He's not accurate. It's McLuhan said, and interesting, Engelbart said that in 1968. Well, that tremendous statement that McLuhan made somewhere is maybe in the redone explorations in the Varsity Graduate U of T magazine. Mm-hmm. In 1968, he said, the hologram will take the audience, it will take the intellect and wipe it off the deck. It's a really amazing sentence. I don't have it right here immediate, but he's basically saying the hologram will take the intellect, and he calls it the audience of the intellect, and it'll wipe the deck with it. In other words, it'll be gone. So here is Engelbart bringing in the technology that's going to do that, and McLuhan's already saying it's all over for the intellect. But Engelbart naively thinks the intellect is going to be extended here, and that's the chemical body intellect. That's what's going to be wiped out, and not as an architectural addition to real space. Well, actually, that's what did happen. It was an architectural addition to new bodies. To the chip body and TV body.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I guess everybody, they just want to be smarter, braver, this and that. They just thought that their brains would expand.
Okay, well, she tries to define it. In the next sentence, she says, virtual space and augmented space are distinctly different, and it will be helpful to define the difference between the two. The virtual creates an immersive simulated world or place that we interact with, like the mainframe in The Matrix or the holodeck in Star Trek. Augmented reality is, by contrast, a layering of dynamic digital data over real space, like the Terminator's readouts on his view screen. Virtual reality and augmented reality are not necessarily mutually exclusive, as Lev Manovich points out, since the difference between immersion and augmentation can be a question of scale determined by the size of the display. The real-time coordination and interaction of real and augmented data is not a new concept. Head-mounted augmentation has been the standard interface in military mechanics since the 1990s, for instance. Mobile technologies that have emerged since 2008, however, are now putting locative media, augmented data mapping, and social media tools within reach of the network individual, the media tactician, and the archivist. Not the archivist, the ART, archivist. So what you have here is you know too much about the technical differences within the subplots of the Android meme. So you get lost in distinctions, but overall it's talking about different parts of the Android meme specializing in creating different dynamics, and why know the details unless you're an engineer and you're selling it and you got to know how to repair the damn thing when their Android meme breaks.
They're trying to drill down into the details and they're missing the overall.
The larger, there's no audience for this paragraph.
Right. Okay, I found your quote on ironandbob.blogspot.
Oh, really? What,
yeah.
What, you just Google it in general?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it came up there? Let's see. Oh, yeah, let me read that. This is in the University of Toronto's Varsity Graduate, number 23, page 68. It came out in November 1968. This is where McLuhan restarted the exploration series from the 50s. He redid it in the mid-60s using the U of T's Graduate Alumni magazine. So here's the quote. When the movies were new, they used literature as content. When TV was new, it used movies as content. The laser beam will use human dreams and the audience of the intellect. What a phrase. What is the audience of the intellect? Is that your own self looking at what you're thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Meta level, self-reflexive? Or is it the audience out there, chemical body or the TV discarnate state, looking at people talking heads?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, I've never seen him use that phrase again. The laser beam will use human dreams, well, you know, exploit human dreams and the audience of the intellect right off the cortex. That means the dreams and the intellect were already on the cortex, and it will scoop up the cortex. So McLuhan is saying right there that the chemical body's brains and dreams will already be flattened on the cortex. What are the court? The yellow submarine? And he says they will be scrubbed but good. Basically, hey, everything's disappeared on any fantasy that your chemical imagination can come up with. In 1968, the same year Engelbert is making his demonstration. Yeah, it's from my McLuhan article, McLuhan and Holopathic Quadrophenia, the mouse that roared syndrome. But the and I got 104 or so quotes, awesome quotes by McLuhan in there, and ending with the Quoker. Go to the last quote. Let's go to Quoker's last, how he ends. The very last, just before the notes. Quoker says, in 1993, this is an update of the 1968 McLuhan statement. We're now in a culture of quantum fluctuations where you can only know, this is all that you can know, you can only know that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at because you have never really heard what you were listening to. In other words, your chemical body eyes, your chemical body ears do not exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you, your body makes it seem that you're looking and listening to something, that's not there. You are a chip body, and that's hard to visualize what that is, and you're embedded into the quantum fluctuations.
Right, and knowing that there is no more flesh, you can make statements like that.
That's right. Quoker knows that. But McLuhan's saying it in 1968. Imagine Engelbert. And here's the guy that's helping him set this up, is Stuart Brand, who's a gadfly. He's like Zalig. He's at every scene. He started a Whole Earth Catalog. He started Wired Magazine. He did all the stuff in between. He wrote the book The MIT Lab in the late 80s that showed how the MIT digital artists and scientists were using McLuhan and Finnegan's Wake and Joyce. And that inspired Don Thiel to write his 90s thesis on the Finney's Way prefiguring digital culture. It's because of Stuart Brand's book. Now, you want to talk to Mark Stallman about the conspiracy that comes out of Stuart Brand. I mean, he was a married prankster with Ken Kesey. He was everywhere. He's almost as everywhere as Gerd Stern, and he was a buddy of Gerd Stern, and Gerd Stern introduced him into the whole scene in the 60s. So it comes back to me and Gerd, but Stuart Brand is sponsoring Engelbert's demonstration in 68 in California somewhere,
Stuart Brand is
an advisor to Jerry Brown in 77 when he's governor of California, and Mary McLuhan meets Stuart and Governor Brown. They bring McLuhan in. There's Stuart Brand hanging out with McLuhan. So this guy Brand hangs out with all the operations that McLuhan is making fun of and wiping out, and Brand, he hobnobs with McLuhan, but he doesn't hear one fucking thing that McLuhan's saying about his Engelbert demonstration that he did with Douglas Engelbert. Okay, you know, this is, Brand needs to be spanked. And we actually, we went to visit when we were recently in San Francisco. We visited the Sausalito houseboat zone to see Gerd Stern. He was staying on a houseboat there. And so we go walking around, and I recognize, oh, this is where Stuart Brand has a houseboat. So I wandered up and down the docks looking, screaming, Stuart Brand! Stuart Brand! Because I wanted to invade his little houseboat. And we couldn't find him. And then we ended up over in some other part of San Francisco, and I walked into this restaurant, and it was a restaurant, library, and something else, and it turned out to be the headquarters of Stuart Brand's present operation, which is called the Long Now Federation. They've made some kind of apparatus where they show a clock, and it ticks every 12 months, and it's supposed to tick for 10,000 years. Talk about, you know, bugging ion with retrieving time. They've got this project that we must have this huge Long Now and watch this machine tick for 10,000 years so that we can know where we're at. More nonsense. And so I talked to the guy at the door. I said, is Stuart Brand here? He says, well, he's sort of retired. He's not in charge of it anymore. But he comes in occasionally. And I said, where's his office? And he pointed out his office upstairs. And I said, would he be in there on Monday? Even though I knew I wouldn't be there Monday. He says, yeah, he might be in. So here it is. I'm screaming for Stuart different brand in one part of San Francisco, and then, you know, a day later, I'm over in another part, and I didn't even know that it was the Long Now Foundation was upstairs in this restaurant I walked into. So I accessed him anyways without even trying.
Look what.
And I'm still screaming, Mr. Brand, come on board here, and let's have it out about what your bad McLuhanism. And remember, he's the one who interviews in the very premier issue of Wired magazine in the spring of 93, the big breakthrough magazine, which has McLuhan on the masthead. He interviews Camille Paglia because he says, you know, you're the only public intellectual that reminds me of McLuhan, so I'm interviewing you. And so they start off. Brand is always looking at things through McLuhan, but he's a failed McLuhanite, and Gerd Stern can tell you a lot more about Stuart Brand, and maybe he does talk about Stuart Brand on the long interview with Gerd Stern, my 24-hour interview. He exposes Stuart. He's got a lot of stuff on closets.
Listen to this. The Long Now Foundation hopes to creatively foster responsibility in the framework of the next 10,000 years. So that's what we've talked about. Creativity is dead. Responsibility
is
doesn't
dead.
Exist. So.
As Carolyn Gordon says, activism is silly. Activism is so obsolete that these guys are saying, okay, well, let's whatever Android meme is around for the next 10,000 years, let's talk to them and urge them to have a conscience. That's how silly their project is. You know, we must think ahead. It's just old revamped space-affected media ecology
and
nature ecology.
Look at what he says here. He says, when I was a child, people used to talk about what would happen by the year 2000. For the next 30 years, they kept talking about what would happen by the year 2000, and now no one mentions a future date at all. The future has been shrinking by 1 year per year for my entire life. So what do you think? Is he in the timeless state, or is he
he's in the timeless state, and he doesn't recognize it's the obsolescence of his brain. He can't describe the present, the big now, and it's called the long now. Is that what it's called? The long, he's trying to expand nowness.
Now.
The now is gone, so they're turning the now into an art form and making it a long now.
Yeah.
Now there's a McLuhan a pattern there for you.
Yeah.
And you know, when movies were new, they used literature as a content. Well, when there was no more now, the digerati used the long now as its content, the past, the rearview mirror. Now, isn't that great, people? You're fantastic insights here from
Calm
Bob.
Calm down, Bob. Calm down.
Well, I'm carried away. I'm excited about my own brain inflame.
He says, I think it is time for us to start a long-term project that gets people thinking past the mental barrier of an ever-shortening future. I would like to propose a large...
See, ever-shortening future. If you want to still communicate in the public, you cannot admit that it already happened. Remember Sun Ra? It's after the end of the world. Don't you know that yet?
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's Brand thinking that there's still a little bit of future. It's coming every 16 seconds, but it's still a little bit coming that we can work with. He doesn't know it's past, and he's gone, he's dead, he's wiped out, and there's no need to have a new project.
And then he proposed the clock. Brian Eno is...
All the regular jerks are in it. And they're all... Brian Eno used to hang out at the McLuhan Center when Derek was running it in the late 80s, early 90s. He used to go to the coach house.
Oh, look at
they're just lousy students of mine.
Look
they don't know about me. They don't know how I can update their sensibilities. I was even smearing Eric McLuhan on his own book on Minipin Satire, Limited. He did his own work, his own expertise. I am such a brilliant critic of everything that's going on. And a wonderful, positive person because I got the solution to everything. Go ahead.
Look at his name. Brian Peter George St. John Le Baptiste La Salle Eno.
Is that his name?
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
Maybe he's beginning to realize he's many more people and many more
mm-hmm.
bodies, and so he added all these names later.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get back to where Gwertoning, where does Gwerton fit into here?
Okay, so we did this business about the information moving off the screens and into the chip in our head.
Into the world. And her language is not perfect for me. And I would say it's not moving anywhere. You're just adapting new layers. She's called augmenting new clothing, new digital interfaces of subtle masturbation potential.
All right. She continues on in that paragraph. I don't know if you want to look at that, where she talks about the virtual creates an immersive simulated world or place that we interact with, like the mainframe in The Matrix or the holodeck in Star Trek.
I already read that.
Oh.
Yeah,
my hour up? Is that
no,
happened?
No, no, I read that.
Okay, here's the next topic that I was interested in, and I did ask you this. According to Guy Debord, a psychogeography...
Where are we now? What, did we move?
We moved.
Where to... Oh, yeah, no, next paragraph. I see that.
Oh, good. A psychogeography is the point at which psychology and geography collide, a means of exploring the behavioral impact of the urban place.
Yeah, remember I was telling you that the other day about psychogeography?
Mm-hmm.
This is another one of the inventions of the situationists in France in the
mm-hmm.
60s. They would go down out-of-the-way alleys, strange, off-the-tourist beaten track, and find interesting places or look for chance encounters in these places where any respectful, educated snob would be nowhere seen.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of life we've lived. We've been psychogeographics incredible on that meme for decades because that's how we found Garrett. That's how we found Dave Worser. Those are guys who were down in the hidden alleys and the sidebars of the forgotten ghettos, right? So that's what psychogeography is. It's you make an epiphany out of what you find. That's your psychology merging with geography.
Right. Well, that's interesting because it's always labeling for them. It's like they should just say to people, oh, go off the beaten path, but then they call it psychogeography, which is so
Well, they're poets. They're right. The French are very verbal, and they're left hemisphere people, and trying to be non-left hemisphere, and they're trying to create counter left hemisphere experiences, but they can't leave their medium, their programming alone.
Right.
So they keep writing. Even Derrida thinks writing came before acoustic space. That's
right.
How backwards he got. But the
So
psychogeography.
Yeah.
There is. Why not say a new word? Since people are get into ruts with cliches. So yeah, they're not
making new cliches. I think that's what bothers me. They're just making new cliches.
Well, then you need to read McLuhan's From Cliche Archetype book because it's about how old archetype becomes new cliche. And old cliche becomes new archetype. The interplay of cliche and archetype would collapse your objection there.
Thank you.
Your limited use of the word cliche.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's double probes going on constantly. It's a tetradic probing. You're enhancing, obsolescing, retrieving, and flipping constantly, simultaneously. So
they're eulogizing the psychogeography.
Let me read the next sentence where she explains it. Guy Debord, who coined the phrase spectacular society, or the spectacle of society. Debord saw in psychogeographies the potential for counteracting the numbness that the spectacle of mass media imposed on us. See? Just trying to get people to go off the beaten path. But right at the point he's doing is when their brains are being scrubbed off the court deck. So there's nothing to travel around with.
Yeah.
And locative media has been wildly criticized for its very lowbrow accessibility, paradoxically coupled with ties to the military-industrial surveillance network, GPS satellites combined with its tethering to consumer electronics. So, the Android meme is intertwined with everything. So what makes you feel more mobile and free and independent of the old rearview mirror mass media complex you're afraid of, what makes you feel separate from that and liberated is also, because that's just the synesthesia effect, the illusion of you getting a different wrinkle of your sensory mix and post-sensory mix, but at the same time the co-anesthesia of integrating you with every matrix phenomenon that already was is increasing. So you're always being killed on the chemical body level. You're gone. But on the digital level, you're always being enhanced and buried at the same time, digitally. But there's nobody in charge of the digital environment, and so everybody's free, including Big Brother, including the corporate guys. Everybody's free to be ignored and to pretend they're running some show. That's what your Facebook page is. That's your domain. That's where you broadcast. That's where you think you're in charge. And you can like and dismiss and what is it, mute people. See, you can be a fascist. You can be a communist. You can be a Marxist. You can be a monarchist. You can be an anarchist. And always with a healthy passion for order. That's your quadriphenic fate in this situation. And the Android meme is doing it before you.
So she goes on to say, we can think of psychogeographic engagement as participatory culture, a smart mob of sorts that eliminates the audience and reinserts us back into formative story spaces as activists, authors, interactors of our own stories.
Yeah, you know, analyze that. A lot of romanticism there, right?
Yeah, just walking around, talking. And what she brings up later, let me go back and find where it is in your book. She talks about the, do you know the word flaneur? F-L-A-N-E-U-R.
Yes, I was going to bring that up. They were the original psychogeographers 150 years ago,
yeah.
In 1840. They wandered around Paris looking for accidents of shop windows and strange non-romantic, non-Coleridge, non-Wordsworth, non-Keatsian, non-Byron spaces. They realized they were stuck in the city, so they turned the city atmosphere the way Wordsworth found the moors of Scotland romantic. You know what I mean? Looking for the picturesque out there in the windswept Lake District,
mm-hmm.
and all that stuff that the romantic poets did. Well, Baudelaire and his buddies, the flaneurs, did that right in the downtown Paris. They found
mm-hmm.
the sublime there. That was the difference.
Yeah, I looked up the definition there. Flaneur is an idler or lounger, and Gwerton says, the original wanderer in city spaces, the flaneur, was an urban soul who emerged out of the new cityscape of the early 20th century. He was a ghostly wanderer who transformed his surroundings and who was at one and at the same time an outsider and a part of the crowd. For the flaneur, navigating...
Now, let's hold that. Outsider and part of the crowd, same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not in the beginning of the 20th century. The flaneurs, look up the scene. I mean, that's Fly Gautier and those guys back in the 1840s, 1850s.
Hmm.
Look up Gautier, G-A-U-T-I-E-R, Theophile Gautier, I think it is. So, now, what she said there... So in the chip body, you're going to get new wrinkles of autonomy that you can express yourself even super ways, like this periscope or whatever it is that someone was telling us about, you know, where you can broadcast from anywheres, while mobile. Donald Trump apparently is exploiting that as much as possible, using it. So you have more and more autonomy for you. That's synesthesia. That's mixing up your bodies and making them be not measurable. At the same time, you're being integrated into digital prohibition. The Big Brother is going along with the anarchists at the same time.
Yeah.
So you're getting more and more autonomous, and you're more and more getting embedded in the mob, in the crowd, like the flaneur. The flaneur is the archetype for the chemical body.
Right. Yeah, so...
Did you look up Gautier?
Yeah, there's Theophile or whatever.
Yeah. What's it say about him?
He wrote a book about flaneur.
What's his dates?
1848.
What? What happened that year?
That's his date.
No. When was he born? When did he die?
Yeah.
You looking at Wikipedia? That organizes it.
I know. I'm looking at flaneur and Gautier at the same time, so let me go to Gautier.
You just have to read the first paragraph with the dates.
Yeah.
Wiki.
1811 to 1872.
Yeah, so how does it describe them? Just read what Wiki says, the first sentence.
Bob, there's a lot here.
Yeah, just say the first sentence. Want me to go do it?
A French poet, dramatist, novelist, journalist, and art and literary critic. Ardent defender of romanticism.
Keep going, because it's going to mention the flaneur.
It doesn't.
Well, read the next paragraph. I guess I'm going to go over there myself, people.
Oh, yeah.
You just have to read. But what
there's
you say?
No, I search for flaneur. There's no flaneur.
There he is. While Gautier was an ardent defender of romanticism, his work is difficult to classify and remains a point of reference for many subsequent literary traditions such as Parnassianism, symbolism, decadence, and modernism. That's all the guys that I talk with Dennis Young in my recent dialogue with Dennis Young. We go into those phases. He was widely esteemed by writers as diverse as Balzac, Baudelaire, the Goncourt brothers, Flaubert, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, Henry James, Proust, and Oscar Wilde. Okay, now let's go down to the next part. Let's see, life and times. We get past the schooling, get down to this present, influences, criticism. He spent the majority of his career as a journalist, He saw journalistic criticism as a means to middle class standard of living. To a middle class. Okay. Art criticism. He started off as a painter, contributed much to the world of art criticism. So he's an important intellect. But I'm as surprised that it doesn't go into the flaneur stuff, because I thought he was the original flaneur guy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Poetry, the word flaneur doesn't come up?
No.
Well, maybe he wasn't a flaneur. So so let's wiki flaneur and see where they say that comes from.
I put that in.
Do it in wiki.
Don't get all excited.
Down here. Okay, flaneur. The flaneur was, first of all, a literary type for 19th century France, essentially any picture of the streets of Paris. The word carried a set of rich associations, a man of leisure, the idler, the urban explorer, the connoisseur of the street. It was Walter Benjamin, drawing on the poetry of Charles Baudelaire, who made this figure the object of scholarly interest in the 20th century as an emblematic archetype of urban modern experience. Following Benjamin or Benjamin, the flaneur has become an important symbol for scholars, artists, and writers. So it's, they say it dates from the 16th, the term flaneur dates 16th, 17th century, denoting strolling, idling. But it was in the 19th century that a rich set of meanings, definitely surrounding the flaneur took shape.
And Côté does not come up in it.
So who is the first guy?
Benjamin.
No, Benjamin's the 20th century. He's a nostalgic for it.
Got it.
Balzac described flannery as the gastronomy of the eye.
Mm-hmm.
The true sovereign of Paris is the flaneur. So let's go down. Let's see if they got some names.
Gautier doesn't come up.
We're going to have to cancel Gautier. But he certainly was around there. But they don't seem to, in a way, he's like the first aesthete.
Mm. Okay, so back to...
they don't name any particular
guy. You lose, Bob. Yeah. You lose. So
I don't lose people. I don't believe that.
Okay.
I had all the facts right.
The point I wanted to make here...
Gautier was a flaneur. They just don't know it.
For the flaneur, navigating the city was a visual act and a form of creative expression.
So that's what psychogeography is, a replay of that.
Right. Getting lost was more artful still. So then here's the point. It was urban development and the rise of consumer culture that eventually drove the flaneur out of the city. Replaced by the more productive shopper, the consumer laid little claim on the space of the city itself. So they make the shopper a woman all of a sudden. Her eyes were always glancing toward the next product or commodity. So that's a commodification.
Were you reading
of space.
This? Were you reading this?
Continuing after the original wanderer.
Are we reading Guertin?
We are reading Guertin.
So,
let me find the page for you. Page 114.
What's the paragraph? Oh, yeah, the original wanderer in city spaces?
Yeah.
Replaced by the more productive shopper. So what is she saying about that? Where changes in the cityscape, modes of travel, and data acceleration seem to threaten to make the pedestrian redundant, augmented reality technologies could establish a new kind of wandering in the many layers of real time in urban space for the exploration of narrative space. So that would be what I was telling you, that the chemical body gets propped up, gets retrieved, that is the autonomy that Guertin is celebrating that's coming. That's the service. But it ain't going to happen that way. It can never be finally determined that you did get retrieved and your chemical body is back. You're still going to be just being a spasm, as Coker lays it out, and a life of just hooking up. You see, Carolyn, that the synesthesia is being retrieved, not the autonomy of the body. Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that?
I'm just putting the blinds up. I had to put them down so I could see you with the sunset behind us. Nice sunset, everybody.
So, you know, Carolyn Guertin is looking to find some hope for the chemical body in here, the liberated chemical body. and hoping that, and the NRME will make you think that you have retrieved your physical body and its potential of sensory excess as the chip goes inside you.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I guess it's a romantic nostalgia for the flaneur because they've been replaced by the shopper.
Yeah, Coker, way back in C-Theory, back in the 90s, somebody wrote an essay about the drifting chip body user. The person is on Web 1.0 and floating around and surfing on the Internet. That was a retrieval of flannership. They called it the digital flanner.
Okay.
Just idly wandering around in the new magnetic digital virtual city.
Okay, here's the next point. Do you want to continue?
Yeah. Let me just see what remarks are being made.
Right.
On the chat line, see if there's any perceptions here. Somebody says, wow, that is some serious boogie. Way better than
music.
Disco. Yeah, I know, the music. Then Mateo wonders about the dead air, but we allow the dead air to happen.
Yeah.
So is anybody commenting? See if there's anybody commenting what we're talking about. They're talking about Patti Smith. Still looking for summaries. There's Marvin Gluck saying, the poet Charles Baudelaire described perfect flaneur as a passionate spectator, as a prince who everywhere rejoices in his incognito.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's... echoes Wyndham Lewis's dithyrambic spectator that Lewis made fun of. So, but Baudelaire was, 70 years before Lewis. The alley behind the marketplace, 113 says. Then they quote the laser beam. So there doesn't seem to be any other quotes on our stuff. So, yeah, we can go to the next part. You go where you want.
Okay, so the... Well, okay, this is Capra. This is page 115, and it begins Capra in his 1965 work. It's the second last paragraph of the chapter.
It doesn't, there's nothing begins
paragraph.
Yes, nothing begins with Capra.
It's, okay, it's in the middle of the paragraph.
Yeah, come on, don't start with the actual paragraph. Why would you quote the middle of the paragraph? You're supposed
because
to...
that's what I have in my notes.
Oh, so you have to go to the source.
How yeah. might this richness of place?
Okay, I have it. So that's what you're going to start to read?
Yep.
Okay.
Caprow, in his 1965 work entitled Notes on the Elimination of Audience, explores his invention of happenings, artistic events in which the audience participates. These events were intended to create a heightened experience of the everyday where interactors could fuse with the space-time of performance. He advocated that all audiences should be eliminated entirely and individuals should become participants. So I made a note that was he predicting digital devices and social media where, but then everybody is a participant and a creator and an audience. We haven't lost the audience.
Okay, so confusion of terms here.
Yeah.
The audience he means is the passive person sitting and watching an artist, a ballet, a band, watching passively, which Zappa accused the Toronto audiences in 1977 of being. He said they just sat there and watched them as if they're, watched Zappa perform as if he was watching TV, whereas you didn't get that in New York City. The audience was leaping about and running up on the stage. Canadians were a little more passive. So, and McLuhan said Canadians were a completely 19th century culture of passivity. So that idea of the spectator just observing is what he's calling the audience.
Okay.
And McLuhan said that with the happening, the audience got in the act. But the happening was a theater, was an artistic presentation that mirrored what was already happening in many levels since the 20s. Once you had the electronic vortex of radio, the audience got in the act, and then the dances changed and the people started doing the can-can and the catwalk or whatever those things were and started participating with the jazz and swing bands. And then you have in the 60s, in the late 50s, you have all these dances that the teenager's doing. So the audience is getting more and more in the act in non-artistic, non-elite environments, like in teen music or in corporate activities. In corporations, everybody was taking classes and learning. You had to constantly learn. The budget for education in the corporation is way bigger than the public budget for the school system. So McLuhan's showing across the board, the audience is getting in the act after Sputnik. After 1957, there's no longer any spectators, only actors. There's only crew, he said. There's only crew, no passengers on spaceship Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So McLuhan is showing how this affected the art world and gave Alan Kuprow the idea of letting the audience participate in the performance, the theater presentation, by allowing them to walk around and do various things of interacting. So there's no division between the audience and the actors. Mm-hmm. So you're supposed to notice from this that McLuhan's saying, wow, television, computers, and satellites, the mixed corporate media of those media, created a global participation. And Carolyn Guertin is celebrating the participatory potential of chip body situations. Why celebrate the participatory nature and the, maybe she thinks, enhancing of community, when it's already happening all across the board in all parts of society?
Mm-hmm.
Political correctness is the audience getting into the act of politics. The audience demanding that their culture be represented politically, politely.
Well, listen to this. This is really funny. Last night I...
I want to just say this. His 1965 work, Notes on the Elimination of the Audience.
Mm-hmm.
He should have said, well, that's the public, the spectator, the opinionated spectator. But when the mass man gets involved with what's going on, the audience is not eliminated. The audience is more involved, but not as the spectator kind of audience.
Mm-hmm.
So his terms are not precise, as McLuhan was doing in his own books. Okay, yeah, you wanted to say?
Right. You said something about people protesting or complaining. I missed exactly what you said.
In politics.
Oh, yeah. Well, last night I watched the movie on my computer, The Ridiculous Six. It's a new movie by Adam Sandler. Mm-hmm. Is that his name?
The comedian?
Yeah. Yeah, I like him. Slapstick, total ridiculous slapstick. I really like his movies. And he's got a new one. Vanilla Ice is in it. It's called The Ridiculous Six. It's a cowboy movie. And
Who's Vanilla Six?
Vanilla Ice.
Who's that?
He's a singer, white rapper.
Oh, the guy that got smeared a couple of decades ago?
Yeah.
The terrible rapper? He got disgraced?
I don't know.
Just Google him. Look at him, Vanilla Ice. And is that
why don't you Google him?
Well, I'm busy thinking.
And there you have it, folks. This is our success. Bob thinks and I do. Robert Matthew Van Winkle is his name, born 1967. Known by his stage name Vanilla Ice, is an American rapper, actor, and television host. Released his debut album, Hooked, 1989.
Yeah, he goes way back there.
Mm-hmm. Although Vanilla Ice was successful, he later regretted his business arrangements with SBK, who doesn't, which had paid him to adopt a more commercial appearance to appeal to a mass audience, blah, blah, blah.
So he is the pink rapper that we all made fun of. So now he's in a new movie.
He's in this new movie with... an Adam Sandler movie, and I've just lost it. And let me get it back again. And it's a cowboy movie. The Ridiculous Six are a group of cowboys. And anyway, during the filming, apparently some of the Indians in the group protested at the stereotypicalness of the portrayal of Indians. And, Adam Sandler apologized and everything, but Vanilla Ice supported Adam But the thing is, I mean, the white cowboys were portrayed as the most so horrible, ridiculous stereotypes, you know, and nobody came out and said, what about us white guys?
Yeah, they're making fun of us.
Yeah, they're making fun of us.
Yeah, good point.
And the one black, was he stereotyped? And, Mexicans, were they stereotyped?
Now, you know what that is? See, what is it? What's doing the talking and thinking and complaining? It is a consciousness that is saying, this ruins our image in the TV landscape or the TV body.
Yeah.
And we're going to be, we're dealing with a chip body economy. So the thing that's protesting is the TV body aspect of that being that protests. And it's a group of them, I guess, called Native Americans or something.
Mm-hmm.
This meme of humans. This meme of chemical bodies who think they're fucking Indians or Native Americans, whatever they want to call themselves, and they're objecting to how they're presented in the TV body and ignoring the fact that they're ripping off the chip body economy by even participating in making a stupid Adam Sandler movie, therefore wrecking whole children's lives who will be influenced by it, like yourself, and have stupid sense of humor. I mean, they're not looking at the huge disservices of multiple body situations that they're part of. So you can't even say what's doing the talking, other than they're speaking up. They're speaking up about the image of the native. That is only 1/5 of themselves. That's the effect of the movie in the chip. I mean, in the TV body, in the TV part of themselves, of their quadriphenic situation. And you know, if they actually heard what I'm saying, they say, "Well, that Bob guy is fucking ridiculous." I mean, we're not that complex. And it is that complex, and that's what humans, what old chemical body brains don't want to notice. And ION deals with that complexity. That's what's really good about our products, that we know the complexity and we massage it, we assuage it, and we have mind knowledge to help explain and pick it apart. But the always people are talking from a very limited, fragmented position, whereas they themselves are made up of five bodies and are very complex, sophisticated beings themselves that aren't aware of it, aren't aware of their complexity in relation to language. They're hallucinating in a synesthetic situation, and they're ignoring the co-anesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you smiling about?
I'm just looking at all the hype about it. I suppose it'll sell more movie tickets.
No, that's another good point.
Mm-hmm.
They purposely cause a crisis on the stage set so that they can get attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, part of the marketing. And, you know, the actors might not even know that. Somebody in the PR department knows that and uses it.
Yeah, and now the actors who protested Sandler's movie speak out in a new video. So they're just escalating.
Yeah, see, so the video would be part of the chip body where you get access to YouTube or something, you know, immediately digitally can get your broadcast out.
It's a Netflix movie, and Netflix defends Adam Sandler. So, yeah, I mean, if these guys are playing the media, they're just making it up
a controversy. That's the,
yeah.
And since there's no responsibility for the chemical body in the end, nobody can do anything about these mimic backlashes and counter effects on each other. No chemical body can do anything about it. It is any news you get is just a PR release.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking blowing up Paris with someone trying to get a new budget for their terrorism operations or their CIA operations, whatever the hell they were. They were just saying, okay, we're not being noticed what we're doing. We need more budgets. We need more money. So let's blow up some people in Paris so that we can get funding.
Reichstag fire.
Yeah, the point is, well, that's too limited. Look, information is always just advertising. It's all it's doing. So best remain uninformed.
Mm-hmm. Like me.
Yes, like Carolyn, who doesn't even have to be a doctor anymore. She's got the solutions. You just have to go to her website and start buying solutions, and you'll have improvements way beyond anything anybody else is offering.
Okay, we'll just end on this McLuhan quote, which we may have talked about last week, but Gorton says McLuhan was infamous for his performance.
Hey, wait, we have a bulletin. Sky Goddess, who announces she's a flaneur. Which body are you speaking of, Sue? Because there's five kinds of flaneurship now. You got five bodies. So you tend to emphasize the chemical body walking around in Denmark and all that. But it's not something to be proud of. We're not celebrating flaneurship. Flaneurship is the dithyrambic spectator, the actor in the global theater who doesn't know what to do with themselves and don't know how to stay home and do nothing and be incommunicado. Let's try to not communicate. This is what McLuhan said in 1970. What's the future person do? Not communicate. We've got to cut down our communications. This is where Donald Trump is correct. We're going to shut down the Internet. Start bragging about your actual actions. Brag about what you don't do. That's what you should be proud of, that you're not doing this and you're not doing that. That means you're not engaged. You're not in the participatory mystique. Carol has to apologize for being a doctor to me all the time. She has to apologize for all this blogging she does, all this email answering, and everything else she does, she apologizes. Because the king of do-nothing is me. And I'm the role model here. I ain't no flaneur.
Look at the next chat. Sufoti says, Internet surfers are more and more flaneur, wandering along the byways, then interacting by linking and shopping and emailing.
Well, that's Susan. And Susan, are you saying that before I mentioned 10 minutes ago that that's what was written up in Croker's thing in 1993, 22 years ago, they talked about the digital flaneur? I hope you don't think you're offering a new insight. It was an insight for you and for people who didn't know the Croker, but let's remember who did what first. Just so we don't carry away with our puny chemical body pattern recognition.
So back to McLuhan.
All right.
McLuhan was infamous for his performances.
What page are we on?
Who cares?
Come on, I'm taking responsibility for this. What page are we on?
Yeah, let me find it for you.
We're flaneuring we're sauntering through Carolyn Guertin's book.
We are. There's absolutely no... we've got... Page 110.
Oh, boy, you're staying around this whole area, which is in the chapter called Dynamic Data and Augmented Bodies.
And it's like the third, fourth paragraph.
What's the paragraph begin with?
Depends on which one you're looking at.
Is this the McLuhan quote, it starts most of the relationships?
No. McLuhan, too, was infamous for his performances.
Okay, no, wait, we got to see where this is. McLuhan 2. It's right on the first page? Oh, yeah, it's the opening of the chapter.
Right.
So you want to read this beginning. This whole page is good.
Yeah. McLuhan 2 was infamous for his performances. We might think of him as a one-person hashtag Occupy Academia movement or as the poster boy for media performances. His manner was strange in the extreme. Douglas Copeland, 2011, writes that McLuhan tuned in and out of conversation with friends and strangers, and during classes he would ramble, seemingly unaware of those around him, clicking in and out of reality or world. Many people, when describing their encounters with him, said that with Marshall, you had a few seconds to say your hellos or make your point, and after that, he was back on planet Marshall. Isn't that cool?
Yeah, now, that was true, but also... If you held his attention, he would pay more attention and he'd stay around. But he wasn't, as I used to say, tolerating any fools, and he was ionically making his own spaces constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then the next part. McLuhan himself seemed to feel that ever-present media buoyed him up and kept him company. He was plugged directly into human electric and spiritual networks. As a walking encyclopedia, that's like as a quadriphenic. Uh-huh. I should quote this as... Quadriphenic, support for my statement. As a walking encyclopedia and the embodiment of live performers, he was both dynamic data and augmented body. He said, quote, you want to read that paragraph?
Most of the relationships between men are now invisible. So there's the objects under the observable quote.
Well, wait a minute. No. The relationships between objects. Objects are
unobservable. Only relationships
between objects are observable.
But
look, most of the relationships between men are now invisible.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean they've disappeared. Only visually they disappear. They're still physically interactive on the other sensory dynamics and extended sensories on the haptic level.
So, you know, you got to be careful about what invisible means here. So then the next part.
The human bond, the electric instant bond around the planet is invisible.
Now, that would be the co-anesthesia, the integration of humans with each other, inside each other's skin and bodies and the other bodies, is more and more fused. It's the monster magnet of Zappa's stuff, Return of the Son of Monster Magnet, or Wyndham Lewis's Magnetic City. That's the co-anesthesia. Now, let's see if he
he's calling it the human bond. He's calling the human bond the electric instant bond around the planet.
Well, he changes it, the human bond, and then he qualifies it. The electric instant, they're both the same thing. They've merged. The human and the electric have come together.
Right. Dot, 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 which is not unlike the things we were talking about with relation to the mystical body, which is entirely around us and entirely invisible. There you go. There's your mystery body.
Yes, mystery and landscape.
It is hard to understand where the media starts and ends. The media is an all-encompassing service, and man seems to be an inadequate figure.
There it is, inadequate figure. He said in 1950 that human species is gone. Way back in 1950, he's saying this, and here's 21 years later, he's talking about the idea that you as a chemical body are still around is an inadequate figure.
Mm-hmm.
You need to visualize what he would call the discarnate state. And how do you visualize that? You know, how do you begin? And he's trying to describe it to people. But that's supporting what I'm saying right here.
And then she goes on, inadequate figure or socially awkward son, McLuhan loved to perform. His riffs were musical in the extreme and bordered on the hypnotic. What he said was often rhythmic, hard to understand, and begged to be listened to over and over like a favorite song or like Bob.
Carry on.
That's it.
Today we would call him a spoken word poet or a VJ of the medium of performance. Performance art as a form in opposition to the message of art spoken by rarefied objects, so old objects are obsolete. The message of art, the aura of objects, is so far outside the established order, so that performance art as a form in opposition to what the art galleries show, which is a bunch of objects.
Mm-hmm.
So performance art is very outside the established art order, that it exists beyond the realm of language and beyond the realm of the chemical body and beyond the realm of all the bodies, because it's a merged state right now and we're moving into the hexatic body, the sixth level. Carolyn Guertin is replaying Lyotard, L-Y-O-T-A-R-D, the art critic over in Paris, replaying some of the issues about verbal versus post-verbal. And now, when you write a book, that's as far as you can go. You could only describe verbally the new nonverbal situation. And it's better described by Finnegan's Wake. But if you fall back and do prose, you'll find you can have the most advanced perceptions, like using McLuhan and maybe even quoting me, but that's not what is going on. The book fails to communicate what's happening. This book is only for university people, for academics, for people who have to publish so that they can keep their gigs in the universities. This is what literacy is propped up by academia. And they're just as bad as the bankers, as obsolete as the visual space bankers. I wonder what you call it. You got bankers became banksters. So what would you call academics if you wanted to put the gangsters?
Angsters.
Yeah, they just create anxiety.
Yeah.
Yeah, angster. That's pretty good. They just create problems. They want everybody to become a critic. Mm. Develop your critical intelligence. And it's so limited to what the book
critic,
can...
Critical.
The classroom, the professor, the historian, the archivist cannot offer appropriate criticism. It's only rearview mirror criticism. So.
And I've watched you mentoring PhD students, and they're all basket cases because they're... professors, you know, make them feel so inadequate.
Yep. And, they made a mistake of trying to get a PhD, but they're in prison. They have to try to get some kind of thing that makes them think they're going to get on the white-collar track and get out of the blue-collar, hard-working zone. And so it's just another form of slavery, and we wish the same for everybody. But the... this thing about the limited, no medium, you could call them analog medium, no movie, no TV sitcom, no radio show, no documentary, no parliamentary committee, no politician, no political campaign, nothing that the chemical body can do with any old forms of art or old forms of media, separate
analog media can even come near to describe the situation. So that's why Carolyn says creativity in those arts is obsolete. And you're now stuck in eternal 24/7 process. And it's how you grab that process and create an interaction with the other people stuck in the process, which you might call the audience or the consumer of your digital product or of your digital art. That is the situation that we offer a solution for. That's what's incredible, Carolyn. Carolyn Guerin, if you're listening. And she hasn't responded yet. I don't know if I sent her last week yet. I got to check that. We are offering, incredible as it may sound, unbelievable post-media, paramedia, digital blah, 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 with ION. We couldn't have done it with, well, it wouldn't be done without ION. ION is bigger and more powerful than Google. Because it knows more than Google. It can correct Google. It can do all kinds of things. So that's the incredible big news of our situation here. So, of course, to remain the bleeding edge, well, this should not be acknowledged by the centralized co-anesthetic, that's the integrated centralized part of the Android meme. The co-anesthetic will not acknowledge this for now.
The central scrutiny.
They will acknowledge it later, and as it says in the Bible, they will blaspheme the fuck out of us. They will really try to insult us.
In the rear view mirror, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm wrapping it up, Bob.
Well, that was very good, Carolyn. Good to see your intellectual self probing, learning,
thank you,
explaining,
Bob.
Expounding.
Couldn't do it without you, Bob.
No, you couldn't. So the thing is, and you only did this short area.
I know.
It's great. There's a lot of material in this book to spark all kinds of fantastic rants by yours truly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, you're welcome.
I'll make you some popcorn.
All right, thank you.